Hello there, I'm Coach Claire Ackers, ex-employee turned business owner and coach. I'm the founder of Adesse and the creator of Audacity, the 8-step proven program to transform your entrepreneurial journey and become the kind of leader you want to be. I am 100% focused on working with values-driven leaders and entrepreneurs just like you, on their authenticity and mindset, so they can think big and live extraordinary lives. You're listening to the Adesse Audacity podcast. It features interviews with inspiring, authentic leaders, my best leadership coaching tips, and advice from industry experts on how to grow and scale a values-led company. So, maybe you're an entrepreneur or business leader of a fast-growing company who's excited to scale but wants to do it in the right way. Or maybe you're an aspiring leader looking for some inspiration. Wherever you are in your journey, if you're values-led and purpose-driven, you're in the right place. Ready? Let's go. So this morning, I am delighted to be joined by James Gupta, who is the founder of Synapse. James, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Nice to be with you, Claire.
And it's lovely to be with you in your home this morning.
Yeah, likewise, I'm a bit jealous of your bookshelf, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a lovely equaliser, isn't it? Just to be kind of brought into other people's worlds and you can sort of see what they're like at home and all sorts of stuff going on in the background.
It's interesting. Yeah, obviously it's sort of doing it like more and more and yeah, it's interesting, like the dynamic of it, and you get to sort of see a feel for what people are about and stuff like that. It's quite nice.
Absolutely. So how have you been coping over the past few months with the whole pandemic situation?
It's been okay for us. I mean, I don't want to sort of like dwell too much on something negative, given that like we're a distance learning tech sort of business, and there's a lot of like retail businesses that I think have like really been hit hard by it. So like overall, the transition for us has been not too bad. It's had some of its ups and downs. For a team of 9, I think we've had about 3 people who have probably been ill with it, mm-hmm. And stuff like that. But it's been okay. And I think we've, like a lot of businesses are saying, we've probably learned a lot of stuff about how you do these kinds of like remote things and how you sort of like maintain sort of processes remotely and things like that, that we'll be able to apply back into the business when this is over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were having a little chat before we started broadcasting, and you were telling me that you've managed to make the transition pretty easily to working from home. Do you think you've had any learnings and things you'll continue with when things go back to the new normal?
Yeah, I think so we had just started to do like a bit of like flexi time, sort of like core hours, sort of like policies and things like that. And that was, I'd always been a little like a quite open to it, but like, you know, it was a bit of an unknown sort of thing. And I think now the remote working thing, I think, has worked like really well. I don't think we've lost productivity. It's dragging on a little bit now, and I think sometimes people are losing a bit of concentration during the day and stuff like that. But overall, the remote thing's worked really well. And I think when we go back, we'll give people quite a bit more flexibility in how they work and what hours they work and stuff like that. I like the idea of being back in the office, and I think there's benefits you get socially and sort of well-being wise, as well as sort of like from a business point of view. But I could see us having a couple of days that people can choose from to work from home and just to crack on with it. Mm. I've also realized just how efficient Zoom meetings can be. So I had a few weeks period where I basically just like lived on Zoom, and various people from the team would just sort of like drop in for 15 minutes or so. And you can have a really productive like 10-minute call, because you've already set up, you've got your notes and your code and your design files or whatever it is open in front of you, so is the other person, you can just collaborate on it. Whereas if you're trying to do like a physical internal meeting, you've got to try and find a room. If you've got a Mac, you've got to mess around trying to find all the different adapters for it. You've got to check that the base work goes through. You've got to make a coffee and stuff like that. So it's really hard to do anything in 15 minutes. So I think we'll try and keep some of the benefits of remote going. Both internally, but then for clients like as well. It's like I used to travel down to London like a lot for essentially like a 1-hour meeting with a client, and I see there's benefits of doing that from a face-to-face sort of thing and stuff like that. But would they rather have like an hour of my time or basically like the whole day in equivalence of like journey time? So yeah, a couple of things like that I think we'll definitely take back. And I think the processes that we've had to develop over the last few months just to keep the gears turning essentially are really helpful and have helped to reduce sort of people's dependence on me and my co-founder at various points during the day. So I'd really like to keep those up.
Absolutely. You're not the first person to say that to me. There's who was the first time with you the day that they used to spend a whole day for like an away day for the sales team, whatever. They could actually do it over Zoom in an hour or two and then move on. So absolutely right. There's definitely
it was a bit of a psychological thing as well, because I think we were doing it. It always seemed a bit silly to me that I was doing it. So an hour meeting, a £200 train ticket, and like roughly 6 hours sort of like round trip. In that, it's very tiring and like I say, always felt a bit silly. But it's how you deal with older clients from like more traditional industries, and you sort of go, well, it's just what the client expects and this and that and stuff like that. And maybe that's true, or maybe on the other hand, the client was sitting there, oh, well, it's just what the supplier expects, or sort of thing. And now everyone's had to do it. All of our very traditional solid clients have got Zoom now and stuff like that. And they've been conducting, I'm sat in like huge meetings with universities with like 30 people all via Zoom. And they just wouldn't have even considered that an option a few months ago. So I think that's helpful.
Absolutely, yes. What about culture? You mentioned that you noticed maybe productivity is lagging off a little bit, or that you're missing the social aspects of being together in an office. As a leader, what kind of things have you tried or seen being implemented to keep that culture going?
Yeah, it's a good question. So like, I just sent a message to the team yesterday, actually. Like, they've been really fantastic, and everyone's sort of, you know, like taking it on the chin a little bit and been by and large sort of doing things like themselves and things like that to keep them over the tide, like, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the team have just been really great on that has made the job like a lot easier than it like otherwise could have been. There's been a couple of things, and I think there's been a few people who've been like caught in unfortunate circumstances. So for example, one of our developers had coronavirus, was ill with it, mm-hmm. fairly badly, but then was on his 14-day sort of like post-illness sort of like lockdown, and then Boris announced the actual lockdown like on the day that he would have been sort of coming out. So he's been in not exactly isolation, but you know what I mean, for like a fair while. And
yeah,
people have put plans sort of like on hold, or like a bunch of people were sort of planning on sort of like moving house, and obviously that's been sort of like a pain. I was meant to be getting married in a couple of weeks, then going to LA on a honeymoon. That's
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Like, everyone's within the same boat, like, sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, hang on a minute.
Let's
just press pause on that thought, because I didn't realise. So I had a little chat to your lovely fiancé and sales director a moment ago, who we can just see over your shoulder there. You guys are obviously working well together in lockdown in what I can see is open plan learning. And you were supposed to be getting married and being in LA, and you're not. Oh, that must have been absolutely gutting.
It's going to sound really bad. It wasn't. And Manisha's been great. And I think we've just... I had sort of like an anecdote once, sort of like, if you were chased in the woods by a human who was coming after you, that would be really scary and traumatising, and you'd probably carry the scars with you for life, sort of thing. If it was a bear, and it's just an animal and it doesn't really know what it's doing, you'd laugh about it within sort of like 6 months. And I think that's it. This isn't a thing that's happened to us, and you think, God, this is so unfair, sort of thing. It's something that's happened to everybody, and everyone's just going to look back on this year and think, God, that was really, really weird. And everyone's going to have their own stories about what's been postponed. We've been really fortunate. Like, we'll probably be able to push the flights back. We've been able to rearrange the actual wedding.
Okay.
Give us a bit more time to plan it and to save and stuff like that. And yeah,
I love that as a perspective, being able to go straight to hindsight and put it in perspective and move on.
We'll all laugh about this one day. Yeah,
what, one day? Yeah. Oh, we're gonna tell our grandkids some stories, aren't we?
yeah well, I knew this was serious when I was on the phone to my gran, who is 73, and she just said she's never known anything like it. I was like, cool, I've not got a chance, have I? Like,
yeah, 73, so that must have, is that having lived through
Just about post-war. She doesn't like it when I keep saying, what was the war like?
So, Dr. James Gupta, you're a doctor, but you're not a practicing doctor. Tell us your story and why that's the case.
Yeah, fair enough. I've not heard a phrase quite like that. So, I've always been like a geek. I've always been really interested in like software, websites, and video games, and all the stuff that comes with it. So, like when I was sort of like growing up, I wanted to do like a couple of things. So, I always wanted to be a doctor because my dad's a doctor, and we're Asian, and that's just how that works. but at the same time, I was picking up like a really healthy interest in sort of like software, like bits of coding and stuff like that. So around the time I was in sixth form, I started picking up like bits of like freelance work for various websites and stuff like that. Made a little consultancy business out of it and started doing bits. Also started working at my dad's practice, doing various things, and sort of like bits of healthcare roles, taking blood pressure and stuff like that. And also doing some data exports on the thing. So I've always been interested like in a bit like of both. And then when the time came to actually pick my A-levels, I decided I wanted to be a political journalist. So I went to study philosophy instead. And I didn't pick my science A-levels, like, essentially. Did that for a bit. Didn't really like it in the same way that I thought I would. So I dropped out and converted courses to medicine and things like that.
Sorry, I can imagine your parents' faces.
yeah. It was better than when I was told them I wanted to just go and play guitar professionally. That was
Your guitars on the wall there?
Yeah. Yeah, so the grey one I've had since I was 18, and it's awesome. And the blue one I've just bought myself as a lockdown slash whatever present to myself.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the kind that I've always always really wanted. So any sort of like guitar fans in your audience, it's a Gibson 2019 Les Paul. And I've never seen anything quite like that colour. So
your parents' faces when you did a U-turn and...
They were really... Well, I went to work at my dad's practice for a year, really liked it, and then did the conversion course to medicine, which they were a lot happier with, but they'd never sort of like tried to force me down any kind of one path. They just wanted me to pick something that had decent career prospects and I'd be happy with, like, essentially. So got partway through the medical course, really enjoying it, but still had this sort of like nerdy side that was looking for a side project. Mm-hmm. I've just always had something else to do, just to focus on. So Omer, my co-founder, built an app called MyCQs at the time, which later became SignApp. And what it did was it let students create their own sort of like multiple choice practice questions, practice them on the phone, and then share them out with their friends. Really simple, not really seeing it as a business, didn't even know what like a startup was at the time. It was just, there wasn't really anything out there for it. Students were writing these and doing themselves sort of like manually. Mm-hmm. And it'll be great to be able to have that on your phone and not carry like 1,000 flashcards around with you. So it just took us a couple of weeks. We built it and it started to grow from there.
So I lived with medics at university. When did you time? I used to go to the socials.
Yeah, the socials are good. Like, yeah.
When did you have time to start building this? Because the workload's pretty hardcore, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite an intense workload. It is one of those uni courses that, you know, you could throw as much time into it as you had and stuff like that. I think the app like genuinely helped because it was an app like about studying, and I had built it at the time. I know a lot of like people say this, but really it was to help me and Omer, and to the extent that there was a benefit to it, like other people in the year group. And then the maximum ambition for it was like sort of like maybe this will look cool on like a medical education CV, like at some point, like later down the line. So genuinely that helps, and it works for me because like I don't have like an amazing like sort of concentration span. I find practicing sort of like 3 questions, 5 minutes at a time, sort of like really engaging. Mm-hmm. And then also like I'd spent a year sort of like working at my dad's practice, and that didn't necessarily give me loads and loads of like academic knowledge that you need like as a doctor, but it did give me a decent starting point with like the skills that you need just from like a communications perspective. And then as I was learning things from textbooks and from lectures, I had a bunch of like patient case studies that I could latch that onto, like essentially start help from a, just a learning perspective. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's a bit of like time management, like as well. And I think most medics, most students will do something else like in the spare time, whether that's like a society or like a hobby and stuff like that. Mine was coding. And it just sort of like fits it in that way. But I think I'd have struggled to have focused just on the core stuff if I didn't have some kind of like outlet for the more like creatives, maybe like the wrong word, but you know what I mean? Some sort of project that you own and can just sort of like work on in the evening.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened next?
It snowballed on us, got completely out of control. So like we got a couple of hundred users, then we got a couple of thousands, and then once you got a couple of thousand, that people are making suggestions and you want to go and improve it and stuff like that. So we just spent sort of like 3 years iterating on the product. So going from basics like student sort of like written questions to adding in some of the algorithms that Synapse now known for that look at your strengths and weaknesses and use that to suggest content to you. Then we started like looping in like publisher, like peer reviewed content to help with the exams. And that was our first paid offering. So that made like a big difference to us. And then by the time we graduated, I definitely knew that I wanted to move into this full time. There's various reasons for that, but ultimately, like there's no job in the NHS like or otherwise that can compete with like running your own thing. Sort of like for me, like the flexibility and just how that dynamic that role is and stuff like that. And then also like we got it to a point where I just always would have looked back and thought, well, what would have happened if we did sort of like, you know, push this one to see like how far it could go and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So when we graduated, we moved into like Future Labs at the time, like Emma Shesha's thing. We picked up Manisha and Charlotte. And we just, the four of us just sort of like, okay, we're doing this full time now. We're taking it seriously. We've got something that's clearly quite cool and that students like. How do we pay the bills with it? And how do we get it out to more students and stuff like that? So the original plan was to scale that up as a freemium model sort of to students. So look at medicine, look at law, look at accounting, look at the other Commonwealth countries and stuff like that. See if we could get 1,000 people in a field using it and like 10% of those paying for it, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's really difficult to get students to pay for things. medics are kind of like a bit of a special case in the sense that they're just very, very dedicated like to the course and usually fairly well off, and they will just pay for this sorts of things. Like they're quite used to it. I think a few other professional, vocational, academic disciplines you could do that in as well. But basically our strengths have always been like in a tech and an education sort of like focus team. So we wanted to focus more on that than we did like the viral student marketing like side of it. Mm-hmm. So over the first couple of months, we started to get in a bit of interest from corporates and universities who wanted it as a white label product. So we built a few of those, and very quickly that was giving us a more reliable income stream that we could use to make hiring decisions on than like the percentage conversion of students sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It was also meaning that we didn't need to go and market to students because we could set up a thing for the university or whoever it was, make it awesome, and then the university can just invite their students to it and get them onto the platform. So that's the model that we set on like pretty quickly, and that was sort of 3 years ago, and now that seems to be working like really well. So we've got 14 people working with us now, including myself and Omer.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's really surreal, especially because, well, you'll know this from being in recruitment, like we've hired more people in the last like 4 months than we did like the entirety of like last year.
Wow.
That's just takes like a bit of like getting used to. But yeah, we're figuring out where we are like in the marketplace and like what we do and sort of making it into like a business essentially. Mm.
Mm. What's been the biggest challenge as you scale, do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think we've hit like a pivot point on that recently. So our challenge from when we graduated through to probably about like a year ago was just generating enough money to keep the lights on, like essentially. So you'll know this and your listeners will know this as well, but sorry, tech businesses, one of the reasons they often go for investment rounds is that you need a certain amount of overheads to just, and a certain amount of runway to just figure out what your product is and who you're selling it to and that sort of thing. And you need a bit of breathing space to make some mistakes and to pivot and change and things like that. So like the first challenge was definitely just that. So we did manage to convince some investors, I think mostly on the strength of what we'd already done whilst we were at university, to give us like a bridge round essentially of like 80,000 to just get an office, get a couple of people in and have 6 months figuring out how we monetize the thing. But obviously 80,000 in when you've got four sort of people doesn't really last you all that long. So it was, you know, it was going sort of month to month and paycheck to paycheck and client to client, just trying to win those sorts of deals.
A few sweaty brows behind the scenes.
Yeah, a couple of credit card bills and like all the rest of it. but it was it's a really, if you get through that sort of process, it's and I'll just also add that I think that process is quite true, like in Yorkshire, like in the north of England, because you've got the stingy Yorkshireman, like sort of like effects, and I think it's different to London and it's different to San Francisco. So like obviously, like the who's how much money people are willing to put into like early stage ventures. I think that's changed just over time anyway. I think people do want to see some revenues more early on and a bit more risk averse with like early stage investments. So you've really got to show why you're worth it like early on.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. I love that idea. So I love the idea of like a traditional Yorkshireman going, go on then.
How much?
Exactly. So I do think we're obviously in a bit of a bubble in Leeds. You know, there has been a lot of investment. There are some amazing tech businesses around, you know, sort of bigger ones coming up here, but also startups and, you know, really, really exciting entrepreneurs who are choosing to be in Leeds because it is really, really...
Yeah, no, it's great.
There's an entrepreneurial spirit, isn't it? It's almost tangible. Mm. It's really, really exciting to be part of.
And it's the network. It's, you know, like if someone moved up to Leeds and they went out to one of the events and they bumped into me or you or Vanna or Stuart and they would bump into one of us, they'd find their feet really quickly and someone will point them in the right direction and stuff like that. I think it's a great community.
Do you think that perhaps the criteria for lending being a bit more, or investing being a bit more stringent with this Yorkshire character you describe? And I'm being quite careful because I'm from Cheshire originally.
I'm from Ormskirk.
Oh, really? do you think that perhaps you have to be a bit more robust as a startup? You know, have to be a bit more serious with the plan to get that cash?
Yeah, like maybe not necessarily like around the plan. There's a definite discipline that people are looking for, and there's a way of like framing things that you've got to do. And I think it's good, like overall. Like I think there's a bit of like a bubble in startup sort of thing generally. And I think the idea from like 5 years ago or so of find 10 early stage B2C sort of companies with youngish sort of like founders, throw £1 million at them, you'll lose £9 million, but one of them will become Facebook. Like I think that sort of like scattergun approach has been, people have been turning away from that for a while. So investors like around that country are looking for earlier on sort of like revenues anyway. And I think B2B has become so much more fashionable than it was like 5 years ago. So again, 5 years ago, it was the Facebook like sort of like thing. Everyone wanted like a B2C consumer tech, viral growth, organic growth sort of like startup. Now, a lot of the excitement is around B2B subscription-based businesses. So let's look at like Slack, Zoom, which is now worth more than the top five US aircraft.
Gosh, I wish I had shares in Zoom.
Yeah. and that works well for the Yorkshire sort of mentality. So you know, our investors are really like fantastic. One of them is that Yorkshireman, and he made his money from a very old-fashioned sort of process of like having a raw material, applying a process to it, and then selling the finished product like at a markup, and did really well from it.
Yes.
So explaining to him why a company sort of like sign up that might have been at the time turning over like 100K in revenue was worth sort of 2 million or something like that by my estimates, and then when we got it reviewed and stuff like that, is difficult to him because he's making a comparison to sort of like his company and to how many units he'd have to sell and stuff like that to do it. And it's the way that it took us a bit of like going back and forth and to get that across. And I realized later on that that's the reason that we weren't seeing eye to eye on it. So I sort of explained it in the sense of don't look at this as like 100 grand worth of revenue. Look at this as like the phase 3 trials for a new drug. Mm. So it's like, it's not about the fact that you're making 100,000 so much. It's about the fact that you've built software and that people are willing to pay, that 5 people are willing to pay 20 grand a year for. And you've got all of that infrastructure in place. And we don't need to double it to double the revenues. We've got that initial seed, and now we just need to go out and find more people.
Yes.
So to bring that back to your actual sort of like point, because I realised that was a bit of a tangent.
That was very interesting.
I think the thing in Yorkshire is really good, because I think you've got a lot of high net worth individuals who are maybe don't see themselves as angel investors, but could potentially be. People who've made the money in like various bits and are sort of interested in putting the money back into Leeds in a way that gives them a return on it, but also helps the next sort of generation of entrepreneurs. So like, I think there's like a lot of that that you can tap into. And if you look at the types of companies that are springing up through Leeds, there's a sort of pattern to it, which I really like as like a Yorkshire startups thing. And I think it's great. It's this sort of part agency, part consultancy when you're getting started model. So that's what we've done. It's definitely what Anna at the Data Shed's sort of like done. I don't know about Pan Intelligence, but there's an element of that high value sort of business SaaS where you're winning enterprise contracts like fairly early. And I know a bunch of other companies that are doing it like that as well, because I think we're not going to get £500,000 seed round on the basis of pitch sort of like alone. Mm. We might get 100,000, then you need to bootstrap it by getting your first few clients on consultancy, having them as your first investors to an extent, and then building a scalable platform off the back of that. And I think it's made a bunch of really resilient companies like here in Yorkshire that are doing the startup thing, getting investment, but also employing people and turning over sort of like healthy revenues fairly early.
What qualities do you think the investors saw in you?
I think they definitely were investing in me and Omer, like as a team around the first one, because there wasn't really much else to go on. It was probably a large fear of, well, look what these guys managed to do when this hasn't been their main focus. If we put some money into them now, they will do something, and maybe it's for this business, or maybe it's not, or maybe it needs a few pivots. But I think that's something they're buying into. I think it's the team and the sort of like the passion behind it. I think if you've got, what's that phrase, like, a good team can make a bad idea work, but a bad team can't make a good idea work, and that sort of thing. And so I think they liked the idea like itself, but would pretty much have to take our word on like a bunch of like the market research and why people liked it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And if it was me and I looked at sort of like me and Omer, the thing that I just am really grateful to all the time is like, me and Omer have a similar background and similar interests. So he's a sort of former medic as well. We're both like a bit technical, so we helped to build the first couple of versions of it. But then over time, we've just like really naturally fallen into the sort of like CEO and CTO role. We've like Omer's just I shouldn't be saying this for a former recruiter, but he's like a phenomenal developer, and he's really grown into that role now with training up like the new devs. I've learned bits about CEOing to the extent that that's a term, but you know, all of that, the negotiation stuff that you do and things like that. We know enough about each other's roles to sort of like see eye to eye on it. Like, we've never had a blowout sort of like arguments and stuff like that.
Really?
It's always really boring when we have disagreements. It's like, yes, I understand your point, but <you consider this." laughs>
I think that's really important, isn't it, to get the right mix of characteristics.
It's really fortunate, and it's just really weird how it happens. Like, I'm not a huge sort of like faith guy like or anything like that, but I went to Radford University, which you know because it had a foundation to medicine, and I didn't do my science A-levels and stuff like that. So sometimes I'd have thought, God, if I'd have just decided what I wanted to do at sixth form better, I'd have saved myself sort of like 3 years and about 30 grand worth of fees, because I could have gone straight to med school. But I met both Manisha and Omer at Radford University, and this happened. So it's just really weird.
Well, on that point then, what advice would you give yourself from 10 years ago?
So I always have to preface this with sort of like what I've just said, which is like, I kind of like don't regret anything, because it's sort of like that butterfly chaos effect, like sort of, yes, like thing. Like, if I'd have changed something, even if it might have been a more sensible decision at the time, I'm sure that if I went to a different university doing a different course, I would have ended up finding someone sort of like personally, and I would have ended up going into a software sort of like business with someone. But I don't think my co-founder would have been an Omer, and I don't think my fiance would have been a Manisha. So I kind of like don't want to change anything and re-roll the dice. Having said that, so me from 10 years ago, if I could sort of like change something, I really wish I had actually paid attention during music lessons.
And
it's, it might seem a bit of a strange one, but I just always like really liked music, and I wish I picked up like the guitar earlier, because it's been such a really good outlet for me, just from a zoning out and having something else to focus on that's not, holy crap, what are we going to do about this, like sort of like thing. And I think kids pick up things like music theory and like the notation like a lot quicker than adults do, because kids, you say to a kid, well, there's seven notes and this is a sharp, kid's just going to go, yeah, okay. Mm. Whereas for an adult, you've got to try and like make, it's got to make sense within your existing thought pattern. So it's taken me years to do it now. Mm. So I wish I'd done that. Then I had like more sort of like connection with music, like as I am now, and I'd just be better at it. And I think from a well-being and like a work sort of point of view, I think that factors in as a hobby. I'm not really making sense, but basically that's the only thing that I wish I'd done different.
Yeah, no, I think it does make sense. And I've heard before that there's quite a lot of similarities between coding and music theory, certainly. So yeah, some sort of wiring in your brain.
It's weirdly mathematical and problem solving and stuff like that. And I've been fascinated for ages, but I've got a book on like the physics of music, like essentially, because okay. I'm really cool. but so here's something that you might find interesting. So there's an infinite range of pitches, right? So if you're playing a musical instrument, all you're doing is, you know, on a guitar, for example, making a string vibrate at a certain wavelength, and our ears interpret that as pitch. So there's an infinite range of them, from like below 44 hertz, we can't really hear, and then there's probably like there's a higher limit and stuff like that. But your brain subdivides it into repeating patterns of seven notes. That's why you've got A, B, C, D, E and stuff like that.
Yep.
So if you get a guitar that's tuned at E and you start tuning it up, your brain doesn't hear like 440 hertz, 441, 442. It pitches it to E. There's something built into your brain. And then when you get to an F, it just suddenly goes, oh, now it's an F sort of thing. Oh. And so the seven of those, and they repeat, so it goes A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and then you start like again. It's higher, but your brain recognises it as the same note based on like ratios and stuff like that. The seven of those, there's seven colours like in a rainbow, and that's the same sort of like thing. It's an infinite series of wavelengths that your brain subdivides to sort of like make sense of it. And that, you can remember sort of like seven things on average and stuff like that. The number seven sort of like appears quite a bit. Mm-hmm. When people report synesthesia through legal or illegal sort of like means, they say basically that they can see colours and stuff like that, and like the note of an A would correspond to red and stuff like that. And there seems to be something that your brain is trying to make sense of the world by subdividing these infinite ranges into things that, not only just things that you can understand, but things that are beautiful and harmonious and stuff like that as well.
That's quite a beautiful expert thought, isn't it? Quite comforting.
Yeah, it's really interesting if you sort of like meditate on that for like a little bit, that capacity exists like within us, so we appreciate it.
How interesting. I think there's a business idea in there somewhere, isn't there? I'm not sure what it
business,
is.
Business,
but...
album, painting, yeah.
Something, power of seven. So talk to me about role models. How important do you think role models are for entrepreneurs?
Can I flip that one back to you? What do you think about that? Like do you think that that's a particularly like important thing? Or do you have any sort of...
So I'm a coach, so I think the most important thing in the world. But I firmly believe that you are the sum of the five people you spend the most time with. And I think you need to be quite careful about who you surround yourself with. Sure. I don't necessarily think that role models need to be more senior to you. Mm. You can get inspiration and support from people more junior to you who who inspire you. I get a lot of inspiration from my kids, but also I don't think it necessarily to have one role model. You can kind of pick and choose elements of people. And like we're saying about all the people in Leeds, all the different companies that are coming up, I think it's quite an inspiring time to be in the industry.
Yeah, no, I think that way of putting it sort of makes sense. It's not necessarily this sort of one person that you've sort of like got, but
yeah,
what you just said, what you tend, the five people you spend time with most tend to sort of rub off you and form your frames of references and things like that. Like, yeah, no, that makes sense to me. And I think looking back, like I've probably got a lot more sort of respect for the idea of sort of role models as I've gotten like a little bit older and stuff like that. When you're a kid, you don't, and it never really like occurred to me explicitly that my parents were role models, like for example. But looking back now and sort of, you know, running a business, which is what they did, like essentially like GPs are privately owned and stuff like that, just like the amount of work that they put in and the decisions that they made and the sort of self-sacrifice they did to be able to give me and my sister like a nice comfortable sort of way of life and stuff like that. And so that's just looking back on it, just thinking, so for example, like, and I never, my mum always said, like, my dad was one year off being a consultant orthopedic surgeon, and he retrained as a GP because he wanted to be able to spend more time with the family. And as a kid, like, you just don't really think anything. That's like, okay, well, that's a doctor, and he was one type of doctor, and then he was a different type of doctor. Cool. Then you go through medical school and you think, bloody hell, like, this guy got to near the top of his field, got to the point where he should be going off to play golf and stuff like that with the other sort of like consultants. And then to spend more time with us, he went, put himself back to being a junior, like, again, like, put himself back into training and went to hang out with a bunch of, like, mid-20-year-olds and stuff like that. When I've got a lot more like appreciation for that. I just seems like the work ethic, like, of my parents has just really sort of like rubbed off on me and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, but isn't that like role models? Yeah, no, I think they're important.
I'm wondering, I hope this isn't presuming too much, but I wonder if you talk about your dad being a GP, whether there's an element in there about helping a wider range of people, and you having your early days of doing the blood pressure tests and so on. I wonder if that's kind of flipped over into what you do now.
Yeah, in fact, actually, I do genuinely think that I'd always worked on and off my dad's practice and enjoyed it. And then when I dropped out of uni, that I did like a full year there, so it became like a proper job and stuff like that. And I think that was, I don't necessarily want to say it was like more formative than like the 7 years that I spent at university, but I definitely look back on it and think a lot of the things that make me now did like come from that year, and a lot of like the perspectives like I've got and things. So like I didn't go into running a business just from a graduate like perspective. Like, I'd seen my mum sort of like managing staff like and things like that. I now manage Manisha and stuff like that. And I knew how my mum treated me at the practice, which was just being completely open with the staff that, yes, this is my son and stuff like that, but he doesn't get special treatment. If he's dropping the ball, you say to me, and like, you're not going to get punished for it, and like that sort of thing. And just having some clear rules and stuff with people.
Yeah.
But also like, there is a degree of sort of like helping sort of people that I've really, really liked. I don't sort of say that too much because I think it's like a bit of like a fairy thing. I think most people want to help people, and I think kind of like whatever industry you're in, there's probably somewhere this doesn't apply so much, but most businesses are delivering some kind of like social good, even if that's not the stated aim of the business and stuff like that. So like at the bare minimum, a business is employing people and providing that.
But
my dad, if I was going to do the medicine thing, I would definitely want to have been a GP, and that's because I saw my dad seeing the same patients over the course of like a couple of decades. So you really get to know the patients as a GP. You're not necessarily a specialist in any particular area, but
you understand
that patient and their family. And some patients, if they come in complaining of chest pain, it's just the thing that they're complaining about that week, and you need to take a certain course of action. Some patients might only ever come in if they've already been sitting on it for like a couple of months. So there's a lot. It's a really nice area of the profession, I think, is GP, where your specialism is in the people in the area that you serve and stuff like that. And
yeah,
and the area that my dad worked in, it's really, really rough, very deprived, huge historical sort of unemployment, but lovely people who just clearly had like a lot of respect for my dad and were really excited when me and my sister started working there.
That's lovely.
Yeah, it was great. It was really fun.
What do the, what do your parents think about what you're doing now?
I think they're happy. They're very proud, and I think they've had their own sort of like experiences in working in the NHS, which mean that actually, like, just from a knowing that your son's got a stable career, like, sort of like thing, that they'd rather I'd be doing this now that science got to like a certain point. And yeah, no, they've just always been really, really supportive, and just excited like about it, really. So they invested in our Crowd Cube rounds, so they've got like a small stake in it each, and like, so does my nan and my uncle and stuff like that. So,
really, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Great.
Like I said, like Manisha and my sister Charlotte were our first employees, and that's just worked out really well, because like we didn't necessarily plan that one out too much. I just knew that we needed people that we could trust and who would work a lot for a not particularly great sum of money as you're sort of like getting started. But so Manisha's a former teacher who, you know, God, I didn't realise how true it was. They did the workload that they put on teachers and stuff like that. And Charlotte did economics. And so we hired them both, and they've just really naturally, and same with me and Omer, have specialised in the sales, like sort of like route. And Charlotte does all of our implementations and customer success stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been... Just every day I'm just really thankful for that sort of like relationship. It's just so fortuitous that has happened, and I think my parents are really happy knowing that we're both, me and my sister and Manisha, in sort of like jobs and live near to each other and progressing and all got each other and that sort of thing.
What advice would you have for aspiring entrepreneurs, people just starting out on their journey?
Thing, like I always say to people, like don't wait for like the perfect time, because there's not going to be one. So people ask me like, how did I start a business at university? But then it's not a particularly bad time, because you're getting your student loan like money in, you've probably not got kids and a mortgage to pay and stuff like that, you've probably not got health problems or carer responsibilities. So like whatever stage of life you're thinking about doing it in, there's going to be a bunch of reasons why it's not the right time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. So don't wait for someone's permission, don't wait for the perfect time, just get started. And I think one of the really big benefits about tech is you don't need $250,000 and 5 employees to get started. Like whatever your idea is, there's probably a version of it that you could deliver through Zoom, through various collaborative tools online and things like that. Maybe it's not going to set the world on fire, but you could probably quite quickly get to the point where it's a nice supplemental income, like sort of thing, and then you'll be learning all sorts about how you do it.
Yeah, and get started, scale when you can.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. Just get started. You've got to enjoy those early sort of like bits. Like you can't be doing, oh well, this is just what I've got to do now, but then at some point we'll have this office and 50 people do it for me. I think one thing that's become like really apparent to me over the last like 3 years is like the way I see it, like, 2 or 3 years ago I was really close to the metal, like on everything, so if anything needed changing it would be me or Omer sort of like doing it code wise or like a process or whatever. And as we layered up, your ability to push those levers, it becomes less direct. So now I've got to go through Manisha if I want to do like certain things, and if I wanted to change the pricing on the website, like whatever, well, that's baked into several layers of systems and things like that. So you've got to enjoy those early times where you've got the ability to tinker with things and play around with that. And as your business grows as a result of that, you give up like some of that control and it gets delegated and things like that. Basically, the advice would be don't try and make things happen like too quickly. I think there's a process that has to go on, that you've got to go on to get you comfortable with dealing with this stuff like at the higher levels and stuff like that. Like I couldn't do what I'm doing now if I was just sort of like thrown into the role, like, and stuff like that. But having done it over a couple of years and being able to make some mistakes in relatively low stakes situations and stuff like that's been really helpful. And then the final one is, assuming the business has something to do with tech, I think people should learn to code, like at least a little bit. And I'm not saying every founder needs to be building like the product or something like that. I think in a lot of cases that wouldn't work. But if you do a 2-week course on Codecademy or something like that, you'll know how a computer thinks by the end of it. You'll maybe know roughly how long something should be. You'll have a sense when the wool's being pulled over your eyes by a developer or an agency or something like that. And you'll just have this appreciation for the ethos behind the stuff that you're building and stuff like that. And I think that's always like really valuable.
I love that early stage where you're just in control of everything yourself and you just figure it out. And it might not be the prettiest thing in the world, but it works and you know what you're doing and then you can scale from there. It's so exciting.
Yeah, you can see why entrepreneurs sort of like have this thing where usually like they get the company to a certain point and then at a certain point it interests them sort of like less because they're so many layers removed from the product and they're hackers at heart and they want to just sort of like go off and build something without all of the responsibilities and stuff like that. But it's weird because like I still spend a lot of evenings like working on stuff. Like I just like having like 6 hours straight to just sort of like focus on something and not be getting emails and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it used to feel like I could get so much done in 6 hours. Like I could add a whole new page module component or something onto the website. And now I can maybe get some mock-ups done for what that might look like in 6 months. And it, on one hand, it feels less productive, but I know it's because just everything needs to go through several more layers and more reviews and stuff like that now, given the stage that we're at.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, I ask everybody this, but what's a book or a podcast that you couldn't live without? What's your recommendations?
Ooh. There's a book called Mastery by Robert Greene. I don't know if that's on your shelf.
I don't think so.
So Robert Greene's done like a couple of like really interesting books. One is, he's got a book on human nature. He's got one on power and mastery. The power one's like kind of like controversial because people sort of misunderstand it. But what he's done is like looked through history at people who exemplified power, sort of like essentially, and tries to like distill their rules from it. So it's sort of like a Sun Tzu's sort of like strategies of war kind of thing.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people think, okay, he's advocating these. It's not, it's how to identify it in other people and how to then apply certain bits of it into your own life as you see appropriate. But then the mastery one is just, I think, great for any sort of entrepreneur. He's done a similar thing. He's looked at people who throughout history have been recognized as having mastered like a certain field. So sort of Darwin, Da Vinci, Steve Jobs and stuff like that. And each chapter is like a little case study on what traits this person exemplified. And one of the things that really like stuck with me from that book is him saying that there's two ways to become like a master in your field, and one of them is to just pick a field and be the absolute best in it. Mm-hmm. Like just be the best neurosurgeon in the world or theoretical particle physicist, like, or whatever it is. And that's difficult, and you're immediately in competition with like 100,000 other people or so. Mm-hmm. The other way that people have sort of done that is you pick two or more fields that people haven't really thought about combining. You become pretty good at both of them and you combine them.
So there we have it, Dr. James Gupta. What an amazing, inspiring story. I'm growing a select community of people like you, values-led, authentic entrepreneurs and leaders who are hell-bent on having extraordinary impact with their business. In this community, you can expect support, inspiration, and advice from people who know exactly what you're going through. Why don't you join us? Search for Audacity from Odessa on Facebook and come on in.